Coming up on Golf Today, we're starting the program with a little records talk, which inevitably means we'll talk Charles Howell III. Do we underrate the ability to play professional golf for decades on end without missing a single season? I say yes. Prepare for Chucky Three Sticks praise. And this morning, when you woke up, you probably thought to yourself, I hope I get some tree talk today from somebody. And good news, your request will be answered. We dive into iconic trees and transition to the popular move of taking trees out at some of the most famous spots in the world. And lastly, a lot of pro golfers were excited on Monday when Georgia won its first national championship since 1980. Another fella happy with the victory, a car salesman that had a five-teamer concluding with a Bulldog victory. The man took home the same amount as the winner this week at the Sony Open. We'll give you the details. It's that time. Run the animation.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Wildlife Country Club hosting the Sony Open's been hosting it since 1965. You can thank Ethan Abbott and the movie It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World for the W trees you see there on the 16th hole, one of the most iconic images on the PGA Tour and something we'll dive into in just a bit. Shane Bacon with Eamon Lynch here as we prepare for the Sony Open. A great event, full field event, first one of 2022, Eamon. And I always get excited when we get a chance to see Seth Rayner's work on display with the best in the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to look forward to this week, Shane. It's, you know, the party's over for these guys. Vacation is over. It's time to go back to work. We have a lot of veterans in the field. We have 24 of the 27 rookies on the PGA Tour getting back to work this week. And, you know, you get the great old Seth Rayner course. It's a full menu, and now we get to feast.
See if we see some scoring like we've seen in the past. We know we've seen 59s here before. We've known we've seen some 60s. But it is a place when the winds are down, you could go out there and fire a number.
Yeah, typically, a lot of times here, you're going to see a winner who racked 20 under par and higher as a winning score. I don't think we're going to see the 34, 35s under par that we saw last week. This is, I think, a more demanding course. It's a little more susceptible to the wind. There's a lot fewer downhill holes for those guys to ride it out on.
A lot of the classic design to have kind of those sneaky, tricky parts of the golf course, and that happens at Wildlife for sure. How about the notables in the field this week at the Sony Open? You see Abraham Ancer in the field, Harris English, Taylor Gooch, Billy Horschel, Charles Howell, the third, Sung Jae, who's played great in this wraparound season to this point, Jason Kokrak, Hideki making a start here at the Sony here in 2022, Cameron Smith as well, and Webb Simpson in the field. Webb Simpson looking for a bit of a bounce back here in 2022. And for more on Webb Simpson, let's welcome in Steve Burkowski.
Good morning, Shane. You just said it. Webb Simpson in his 2021 really wasn't up to his standards for a variety of reasons. And as he kicks off the new year at this event, maybe a good chance to jumpstart things right out of the gate. 11 out of 11 in terms of making cuts in his previous starts here at the Sony Open in Hawaii. Seven top 20s, three consecutive top four finishes in his most three recent showings here. But as he looks to move ahead in 2022, he looks back at a year ago that he ran into multiple issues along the way.
2021 was a frustrating year for me, both physically and, you know, golf performance, battling flu, COVID, neck injury. And I felt like that crept into my golf game. But after the Shriners tournament, I got a lesson from Butch Harmon, and Paulie and I and Butch all agreed I needed to get more on top of the golf ball and start kind of shallowing out a little bit. And we saw some good changes at CJ Cup, and then it got even better at RSM. I took a month off, really worked on it, and RSM was my best ball striking week I'd had all year. And it gave me a lot of hope for, you know, this season, because three things I missed out on, Tour Championship, Ryder Cup, and the Tournament of Champions, and I those are my favorite events. And so I felt like I needed to put in some extra work in this offseason, and so it feels great. It feels great to be here and be able to play a golf course that I love, and, you know, we get some wind, we get the elements here, So I feel like my game's in a good spot, and I fully believe my best golf's ahead of me. You know, I got 5 kids, and so there's always that thought of wanting to be home as much as possible. So I've scaled back a little bit the last couple of years, only playing 20 events a year. But yeah, I mean, it seems like the guys in their 40s playing good golf becomes less and less every year. But like I said earlier, I feel like my best golf's ahead of me. I feel like I have such a great team that, you know, I still have plenty of things I want to do in this game. I want to win more majors. I want to be on more teams. It'd be a dream to captain a team one day. But I feel like that's, you know, I'm 36. In my mind, I've got a good 10 years left. And, you know, Stuart Sink's giving me a lot of hope. He's playing some awesome golf, winning golf tournaments in his mid-40s. So if I can stay healthy and keep loving golf, I mean, I still love golf, which is a blessing. I think it's easy to burn out here. I've burned out many times. But I think playing less, having a smarter practice schedule at home, getting away from the game more has helped a lot.
Webb Simpson starts this new year with a whole level of optimism, if you will. You could hear the excitement in his interview from yesterday. And last year was the first time he didn't make it to the Tour Championship since 2016. He talked about the neck issues, which flared up at Wells Fargo a year ago. He said they feel like they're in a very good place there. A little bit of a bulging disc, but the issues, the pains, that hasn't been around for several months now, Shane. So when you start this new year, you start this week at the Sony Open in Hawaii, keep an eye on Webb Simpson. But as you heard him say, he's got bigger goals in mind and feels like he's got a lot of great golf still ahead of him.
Great stuff there from Steve Burkowski on site at the Sony this week. And how about this from one of the great OG follows on Twitter, Jason Sobel. He said, here's more. Charles Howell III, Mark Leishman, and Webb have made a combined 43 career starts at the Sony, and they've made a combined 43 cuts. Those three guys like Hawaii. It's time now for a little Charles Howell III praise. How about his performances at this event, the Sony Open, in his career? 20 starts, no wins, no runners up. Two runners up there. Has not missed a cut. Has 10 top 10s. Half the time the man is finishing in the top 10. You see total money earned there, $3 million. And this guy is just one of those players I don't think we appreciate enough. Charles Howell III turned pro in 2000. You see 20-plus PGA Tour starts in 21 consecutive seasons. That's 597 starts overall, 29 total top three finishes, 3 wins, 16 runner-up, and 10 third-place finishes. Has made over $41 million in career earnings. And he has won the NCAA by 8 shots back in 2000. And we talk so much, Eamon, about victory. We talk so much about winning and who takes home the trophy. And we spend a lot of time on Monday and Tuesday focusing on those players. But I don't think we give Charles Howell III enough credit, because longevity throughout a career is a skill. Just like winning is a skill, being able to play this long. You know, we sat here last year and praised Phil Mickelson for a long time after his win at the PGA Championship, because Phil proved he has one of the longest careers we've ever seen and one of the most consistent careers that we've ever seen. I mean, he wins on the PGA Tour as an amateur and becomes the oldest major winner. I don't feel like we give Charles Howell III enough credit.
And I think that's partly because of the hype that Charles Howell III started his professional career. We just saw in that statistic there, he won the NCAAs by 8 shots in 2000, turned pro. And I can remember at the time, going back now 20-plus years, a conversation that he would be the rival to Tiger Woods. Tiger was 3 years into his career then. Charles Howell was the next great comer in this game. And it never quite happened. And it's become very easy over the years to use Charles Howell as this exemplar of how there's too much money in golf, because he's won $41 million with 3 wins. And it seems as though it's an embarrassment of riches for not a lot of trophies. But is Charles Howell evidence of too much money, or is Charles Howell evidence of how difficult it actually is to win out there, no matter how much talent you come out with? I tend to lean towards the latter.
When you look at what he's done, you mentioned the money. He's 22nd on the all-time career earnings list. That's something I don't love to bring up a lot. In this instance, I think it helps kind of tell the story. He has 3 victories. When you look at the players ahead of him on that list, the names like Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, it's Webb Simpson ahead of him who has the least amount of wins outside of Charles Howell, and that is 7 victories. I mean, this guy has won 3 times, but to earn this amount of money and to be this consistent, last season was the first time in his career he didn't earn $1 million on the PGA Tour. That takes the ability to stay healthy, I mean, which is something that you see a lot of players run into, especially these days. You've got to stay healthy, and you've got to find some consistency. This typically the time of year where Charles Howell plays his best golf. From Sony basically through Riviera is when we see Charles Howell play great golf on these types of golf courses. But again, I just think when we look at victories a lot and we look at players that win and we talk about major championships, we talk about the players in the FedEx Cup, sometimes we forget to talk about players who have kept their card for this long.
And Charles, in a way, and I don't mean this unkindly, is the Tiger Woods of journeymen, in a way. You talk about the money. David Fairhurty made a very wry observation once that if you were to swipe a card in Charles's posterior, you would get $100 because he was a walking ATM. But that also doesn't just speak to consistency. It speaks, and to physical health, it speaks to a guy who's never really been in swing crisis at all, who kind of had his swing, knows what he has and trusts it, and doesn't go looking for things that he doesn't need to go looking for. To me, the most shocking statistic in Charles's entire career is in major championships. One top 10 finish, and that was 19 years ago. He tied for 10th in the PGA Championship in 2003. To me, that's the shocking underperformance in Charles Howell's career. The rest of it, to me, is indication more of just how difficult it is to get business done out there.
Maybe you need your A-plus game to win on the PGA Tour, and most players need their A-plus game, but to kind of play at that B level being your floor for the better part of your career, it's something to praise and it's something to talk about. And at this time of year, it's something to bring up because, again, he's a name that's been around for a long, long time. I mean, you're talking 20 plus years as a professional golfer, and he was such a great amateur player. And we always talk about, you know, Charles Howell III, and when we get to the Masters, and we hope he gets into that field. But I think, you know, this is the type of player and these are the types of stories that we don't focus enough on in this sport. This sport is tough. It beats players up. You see players go in lulls. You think about Tiger Woods. I mean, arguably the best player of all time going through a time where he couldn't even chip the golf ball. And this is a guy that, again, last year, the first time he hasn't earned $1 million, it's impressive stuff from Charles Howell.
There are 27 rookies on the PGA Tour this year. Do you think there's one of them would not take Charles Howell's career at this point, a $41 million and three wins?
I think they'd say yes. I think they'd take it. You have the trophies and you have the money. Very, very good stuff from Charles Howell III. Well, when Golf Today returns, we continue to honor the life of Tim Rosefort. Jaime Diaz joins the show to give his thoughts on a friend and a colleague. Our friend and colleague, Tim Rosefort, passed away Tuesday in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, after a brief battle with Alzheimer's. He was 66 years old. During his career, Rosefort received both the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism and the Memorial Tournament Golf Journalism Award. The PGA also awarded him a lifetime membership, the first journalist to receive the honor. Let's hear from the Golf Central crew from last night, as well as some of the players.
I think about that smile. I come into the newsroom, and Rosie and I were like a couple of college kids. We had like a secret handshake. We'd do one of these like fingers out instead of a fist bump, and he'd get up. It was always a hug. And it was, Richie, what do you got, Richie? And he was almost always the last guy out.
Well, when I think of Tim Rosefort, you know, he's been out here since I started, and, you know, he was always a friendly face, a guy that you look forward to talking to. I really liked talk to him off camera too, as well as a, you know, big sports guy. So really sad day for the world of golf, but he did a lot of good for us players and for the game.
And I think he really took joy and pleasure in helping people. And you know, you'd walk into a media center, there weren't many people in there that Tim had not touched at some point in their life, whether it was giving him encouragement, you know, giving some advice, writing a letter for him. That's just the way Tim was, and it was nothing. There was no shtick about Tim. I mean, Tim was as straight as an arrow, whether it was reporting or whether it was living his life.
It's shocking, really. It just seems like yesterday I just found out that he had his illness, and now we found out he's gone. It's really sad. I've known him for a long time, and I did a lot of stories with him. Guy had an amazing heart, and he loved golf, and he loved reporting on the maybe a little bit behind the scenes stuff about golf, which is always, you know, the stuff we know, all of us know about it, but we love that Tim had the heart to share that.
This is my opinion on what Tim was. He was curious, and that's what a good reporter is. They are absolutely curious as to why this happened, what happened, when it happened, why did you do it this way? And Tim was always on his two phones, as we said. He was always chasing those stories down. And to me, that's what made Tim such a great reporter and so much fun to be around.
You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, we have many great people in the media,
and TV, and he was always one of those who I think everyone respected him professionally and personally. So it's super sad. I mean, I know that he's been a great friend to my mom the last few years after my dad died in 17 from a similar disease, and so super sad. It seems like it's, you know, I heard the news first of all that he was sick, and it seems so fast that it's, you know, it's already gone.
Tim was always responsible to the exact wording. You never had to guess where he was or what. It wasn't about what he was thinking. It's about what I know, because this is what Justin Thomas's grandfather or so-and-so's coach or so-and-so's sister told me. And oftentimes Tim would look down at his notes because he was reading it to us, to the audience, as it was read to him. And I can't imagine there were a whole lot of times where people came back to Tim and said, you misquoted me. People trusted him. He had a disarming quality. And you know, that's why people shared their stories with him.
And just a lot of beautiful comments all across social media a day ago. Justin Thomas, awful, awful news. RIP to Rosie. Phil Mickelson said Tim was one of the best at what he did. He lifted those up around him and shared insight into the game of golf from an interesting and positive point of view. He'll be remembered by so many he came in contact with, and we're all better for having known him. Fred Couples as well on social media. I like the media. I love Tim Rosefort. Ernie Yells on social. Saddened to hear of Tim's passing today. A brilliant journalist, a great friend, and shared many life discussions. I'll never forget you. And Annika Sorenstam as well on social media. We are so sorry to hear about the passing of Tim Rosefort. I'd known him for many years and always respected the way he went about his business. He was trusted by everyone. His word was gold. He worked hard, but had a soft side. He'll be greatly missed. RIP to Rosie. And the great Jaime Diaz joins us now. And Jaime, you see those comments from some of the great players. I focus more on some of the comments from people that worked around Golf Channel. I mean, you look at some of the people off camera, Alex and Arthur and Aya sharing comments on social media a day ago about just what a great guy he was and how much he touched the people around him.
Such a powerful outpouring, really, of affection, of genuine love. And it gives you, you know, inspiration that it matters what kind of person you are in life. And Tim had real warmth. He handled himself with grace. You know, for a big guy who could look like a, you know, a tough jock, he was a graceful person interpersonally. And it matters. And, you know, it touched everybody, players. You don't hear that from players to that extent. It's almost emotional. And it's encouraging to know that, you know, he reached people that way and that it's possible to reach people who we work with, who sometimes it can be, you know, conflict and awkwardness. And Tim transcended all that in a beautiful way. Eamon is a tremendous reporter. He knows that there's a dance great reporters do. Everybody does it their own way. Tim did a beautiful dance. You know, it's like Jackie Gleason in The Hustler. Look at that big guy dance. You know, he really had grace. And I appreciate it more than ever. I always recognized it, but I didn't realize how universal it's felt.
When you look at the ability to do that dance, Jaime, while still doing your job, that's to me what's intriguing about Tim, because he started in Florida newspapers, worked for four separate Florida newspapers more than 40 years ago before he became the much more public figure that we know. But he never lost that kind of shoe-leather reporter attitude, did he? It carried him no matter where or what platform he was working in.
It's what he had the most faith in. That's what he believed was really why he could do what he did. And he took that as far as he possibly could, because it was his, you know, his North Star, to feel like if I really immerse myself in knowing this, I'll do a good job, number one. But people will respect me, and I will gain, and they will gain my respect, because they're going to, you know, feel like I'll participate in this, because I know it's all in good faith. I know you're after something higher, something that's meaningful, and journalism, and just explaining golf, as trivial as that can sound, it's important when it's your life, and it was Tim's life, it's those players' lives, it's our lives, and if that's the connector, so be it. He went all the way. And I just sort of respect, you know, the effort. You know, it was a lot of sacrifice. He gave up a lot. But I think if he was watching today and yesterday, he would say, it was worth it. I was recognized for the thing I cared most about.
Jaime, you wrote a beautiful, beautiful piece on golfchannel.com. I urge everybody to go read that if you haven't already. When you work to gain the respect of professional athletes, when you work to gain the respect of the professional golfers out there, it's all in your work. It's all in your effort, and it's all how you treat people. And when you see players like Phil Mickelson and Justin Thomas and Annika Sorenstam, I mean, these are the best of the best, all not just talking about who he was, but what he was able to do, the stories he was able to touch on. To me, that was a guy that transcended golf and transcended sport and transcended journalism.
The fact that they noticed, and, you know, golfers try very hard to get in a bubble sometimes, so they're impervious to, you know, distraction. And journalists can be distraction because you're asking questions that sometimes could be uncomfortable or just things you don't want to think about, swing thoughts, you know, what'd you think about, you know, what you were doing when you didn't close last time or whatever. And they do notice, though, that someone is actually trying to get to the truth of things and respect it. So even though it may feel like there's always a distance between us, it's very encouraging to see that there's actually kind of a bond, that we're after the same thing from a different direction.
What was really striking yesterday, Jaime, was the number of tributes paid by younger journalists in the golf space, people who aspired to knock Tim off his perch and take his job, all of whom had a story to share about how he had actually had a word of encouragement and a thought for them over the years. That's not that uncommon. That's not that common in a very competitive business.
I noticed that was the first thing you remembered about Tim, and it really was something that it's been called back to me now on people who just are texting that I haven't been in contact with. I remember the first time I met Tim. He was encouraging. I needed that. It meant so much. I remembered forever. He was that way himself. He remembers starting out. You know, he was not a natural at this thing. He was a great athlete who was a college athlete, and he applied those same lessons of how you get good at sports to how you get good at your job. And he understood the insecurity of maybe being an outsider. And so he was very sensitive when he sensed someone was uncomfortable and maybe trying to find their way. You know, he was there to, like, identify with that and give a helping hand. Because he was such a soft guy, people gave him a helping hand. It was just natural to kind of reach out to Tim because, you know, you just felt like this guy is going to be open and he's going to appreciate it. And not that he needed a lot of helping hands, but just everybody needs encouragement sometimes. And I think he's very empathetic about that.
Jaime, it was a day of mourning, but it was also a day of celebrating a great guy, a great person, a great friend. I, again, urge people to go read what you wrote. And there was so much beautiful stuff out there online about Tim and who he was and what he was able to do and all of the people he touched. Tim, of course, survived by his wife Genevieve and daughters Molly and Jenna and three grandchildren. Tim was 66 years old. We'll be back after this.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Back on Golf Today, time to check in on this date in history. Going back to 1945, Babe Didrikson Zaharias became the first woman to make the cut of the PGA Tour, finishing in a tie for 33rd in Phoenix. They paved the way for so many women in the game. A look at her bio: won two gold medals in track and field at the 1932 Olympics, owns 10 major championship titles and 41 LPGA Tour wins, won the 1954 U.S. Women's Open, competed in several PGA Tour events, including, of course, that tie for 33rd at the 1945 Phoenix Open, and one of the great athletes in the history of sport. Now time for tournaments we remember. We're going to flash back to 2004. Michelle Wee West. At the time, Michelle Wee making her PGA Tour debut at the Sony Open, becoming the youngest player since World War II to compete in a PGA Tour event. She was 14 years old. 14! Who wasn't rooting for this? You know, I mean, we're all just glued to the television.
And the cut the previous year had been at even par. That's where she finished, and she missed by one.
72-68 as a 14-year-old. She tied names like Ben Curtis, Darren Clark, and Jim Furyk. She beat names like Zach Johnson, Adam Scott, Hunter Mahan, Matt Kuchar, Todd Hamilton, and Craig Stadler. I mean, sometimes, you know, players miss the cut, and you just don't think much of it. This was a very important missed cut for Michelle Wee.
It was, because it's so easy to dismiss a Michelle Wee as a 14-year-old playing the Sony Open as a gimmick. And there were a lot of people who did attempt to dismiss it as a gimmick at the time, as others did when Annika Sorenstam played a Colonial. But Michelle Wee beat or tied 62 PGA Tour players, including seven major winners. It was just such a remarkable coming out party for Michelle Wee at that point, because you know, it really spoke of a career that you expected to kind of transcend or transform women's golf. It didn't quite turn out that way, but it was a heck of an opening.
First of eight starts that she made in the PGA Tour. I ask you this because expectation followed Michelle Wee around throughout her career. And when you look at her career, it was quite remarkable and incredible. I contend that the U.S. Open victory she had was the most important since Phil Mickelson when he won the Masters in 04. But was this play as a 14-year-old shooting 72-68 actually bad for Michelle Wee's career, considering she continued to kind of chase the PGA Tour?
I think it's almost like you can make this argument that we see in this King Richard movie about the Williams sisters. What's the value of playing junior sports? And in Michelle's case, she didn't play, I think, enough junior sports. I think you learn to win at that level, and Michelle didn't actually learn to win at that level. She was accustomed to the public eye very early. It was a very lucrative thing in terms of the contracts that she went on to sign with Nike and the public profile that she accomplished. But I don't think it actually particularly helped her game. And you're right, that 2014 US Open win at Pinehurst was perhaps the most important win in major women's golf recently, but I think it spoke more to what should have been than what is.
You're looking at her as kind of what could have been of a career because we thought so much of her. I mean, you look at her career and she had five wins, including, of course, that 2014 US Open. Everybody was watching that on Sunday, hoping it would be Michelle Wee that would walk away with that trophy. We welcome in Paige McKenzie for more on Michelle Wee, because Paige, this is a player that we have talked about for decades. This is one of the more popular names in golf. What are your thoughts on Michelle Wee West when you kind of look throughout not just her career, but when she was a 14-year-old player out there battling the PGA Tour guys?
I mean, did you see that golf swing? It's one of those moments when you look back and you realize how gifted she is and how gifted she was at a very young age. The accolades were more than just participating in PGA Tour events. She Monday qualified an LPGA event at the age of 12. That's ridiculous. And it would be all over the front page news if somebody else were to do it again. And when you think about how she competed on the LPGA Tour, again, at a young age, when she was 16 years old, she had four top five finishes in LPGA events. The promise was there at a very, very young age. And through injury and all sorts of other issues, it didn't quite develop, I think, the way that the projection was there to have, the trajectory that you saw at a young age. But I agree with you in that that major championship was incredibly important. I think it helped validate the player that she is.
Isn't there something to be said here, Paige, for the fact that Michelle did have all of that scrutiny at that age, all of the expectations heaped upon her, including within her own family? She went through all of these swing issues, all of these injury issues, and yet she's actually turned out to be a remarkably positive, well-adjusted adult and mother at this point in her life. That may actually be the achievement that's worth noting here, forgetting about what the actual golf record is.
Eamon, I think that's an incredible point, and it is so true. She's incredibly well-respected by her peers, very well-liked. People can criticize her parents all they want as it relates to the direction that she took as a young child, but there is no handbook when you have a prodigy. And when you look at the person that she has become, there's no reason not to applaud her parents in how she was raised, because ultimately, as we've learned, through the passing of Tim Rosefort, what matters most is the impression that you leave on people. And I believe that Michelle Wee is an incredible human being. And with all of the spotlight that was on her and all of the expectation that was on her, it's pretty awesome to see how she's developed as a human through all of that and used her platform for good. When you consider what she helped the LPGA develop with the Hoodie for Golf and all of the money that they've raised over the past year and a half.
72-68, and I remind everybody that she was, in fact, 14 years old. She was 14 and nearly made the cut in a PGA Tour event. Quite remarkable and incredible. Paige, we appreciate the time.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Shane Eamon, second hour of Golf Today. And I bet you didn't think in early January we'd be talking about the best player without a major title. But this was a debate I feel like always had an answer. And these days it sure feels like it doesn't.
Well, it's one debate that always has a recency bias to it as well, Shane, because we always tend to look at the guys who are performing most recently. And, you know, we're going to throw around all these names that you'll hear in any grill room, whether it's Xander Schauffele or Ricky Fowler or Patrick Cantlay. Not one of those guys has the same claim to that title as a Harry Lighthorse Cooper or Doug Sanders or Colin Montgomery. So the recent, to me, there are two divisions here. It's the current recent guys who still have a realistic shot and the expectation of winning a major. And then there are the guys whose chances probably slipped away at this stage.
Well, you know, Cam Smith just won last weekend, jumped into the top 10 in the world. So we take a look at some of those players in the top 15 in the world. According to PointsBet, the odds to win a major in 2022 to jump off that list of best player in the world without a major. Xander's plus 425, Patrick Cantlay at plus 450, Hovland at plus 475. I know, Eamon, you mentioned yesterday you see Hovland winning a major this season. Cameron Smith there as well at plus 900. Scottie Scheffler, Sam Burns, and Harris English. Harris English coming in at plus 1,200. All right.
Do you think Scottie Scheffler should win a tour event before we start talking about him winning a major?
I don't think you have to. I don't think it's necessary.
You don't have to. Like, I mean, Andy North didn't.
Ben Curtis is doing that. But, you know, we've seen some great players that go through their entire career without a major championship. Who on your list right now is the best player playing that doesn't have a major?
I think you have to put Patrick Cantlay at the top of that list right now. And Patrick only has two top tens in majors back in 2019. He's something of an underperformer compared to his PGA Tour career at this stage. But a guy with seven Tour wins, he's won a FedEx Cup, he's put himself in the mix so consistently on Tour, and yet in those four events, he seems to come up short so often. But I look around this game and there are other guys who seem to have, they're a little more feast or famine. They're not necessarily as consistent or have all of the strengths that Patrick Cantlay has. But to me, of the guys who are in form right now, he's the one you got to look at.
Patrick Cantlay, to me, screams U.S. Open champion. I mean, his demeanor, his way of going about his business, the way he plays, kind of the complete game altogether. I mean, Patrick Cantlay, to me, looks like a player that will win at least one U.S. Open, considering just the way he is. I mean, when you listen to him talk and you see him out on the golf course, he's never going to go up and down for 72 holes, especially at a tough major championship. I'm going to go with an older fellow that's been brought up in this conversations over the years. I'm going to go Lee Westwood. And I'm going to bring up Lee Westwood because we saw Lee Westwood last year get in contention at huge events and nearly win those events. And I think Lee Westwood still has runs in major championships, especially at Augusta National. When you dive into Lee Westwood and the guy's career, I mean, he's got 2 seconds at Augusta National, a second and two-thirds at the Open. He missed out on that playoff, of course, at the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines back in 2008, tied for third at the PGA Championship, 44 professional wins, 25 European Tour titles. I mean, that's eighth all-time on the list. To me, Lee Westwood, and basically his resume, if you will, says he is the best player without a major.
I would dispute that because, yes, Lee's won 44 times around the world, but not one of those wins will make the first line of his obituary. Lee's won the Masters 3 times, but it was the Indonesian Masters that he won 3 times. Lee's a global player, terrific career, and 9 top 3 finishes in major championships. But I really think that Lee Westwood's opportunity to win a major has passed him by, and it's all seemed to happen for the same reason. Sometimes he gets unlucky, but other times his game at the business end of the hole around the greens has always been one notch shy of the guy who beat him on any given day, and that's not the weakness you want to take to Augusta National of all majors.
Yeah, when you go back to 08 and you watch the highlights and everybody remembers the Dan Hicks call and everybody remembers the Tiger Woods putt and everybody also remembers the Rocco immediate reaction, right, when the putt went in from Tiger. But a lot of people forget Lee Westwood had that putt to join the playoff, and it was not a great effort, and it was reminiscent of what we'd seen throughout his career in terms of Lee Westwood around the hole. That being said, I feel like guys that understand Augusta National typically play well at Augusta National. And Lee Westwood, to me, is a guy that if this is something that he is focused on and he cares about, like we saw early in the season last year, maybe he gets himself in contention over the weekend, and then who knows. But I'd like to see Lee have a lighter schedule headed into Augusta National because he played so well early in the year last year, he was inevitably going to burn himself out.
And he never really committed to playing on the PGA Tour full-time in his prime, nor did Colin Montgomery. And because 3 of the 4 majors are here, there's a reason to believe that the guys who have committed to playing here a little more full-time give themselves a better chance in major championships. Lee Westwood's, you know, he's a forgotten man in a way from that 2009 Open at Turnberry. He got the same unlucky bounce into 18 that Tom Watson did, missed that playoff with Stuart Sink. And he's played well in that tournament. And the Open Championship, to me, is his best chance. If there is to be a chance going forward, it comes there because that's the kind of golf course that raw power isn't necessarily the key to victory, and age and guile and savvy and treachery are the kind of things that can work for you in that kind of golf. And I think Lee Westwood has all the armour needed to win there. I don't think he's going to win where a lot under par is the total. I think it's going to be patience and guile that helps him to a major championship.
We talked in that first hour about Michelle Wee and her victory at the U.S. Open and how popular that was. I always go to the Darren Clark victory at the Open Championship and how popular that was amongst his peers. And your point about the Open, imagine if Lee Westwood got himself in contention at St. Andrews at the Open this year, considering the venue and the player. It would be quite remarkable for sure. For more on this, we welcome in Paige McKenzie. And Paige, just your thoughts on the player that you feel like is the best without a major currently.
You know, I'll throw another name in the mix. I think Patrick Cantlay's point was very well made. Six PGA Tour wins, highest ranked player without a major right now. But you saw the odds in Xander Schauffele. When it comes down to who plays major championships well, this is a player that has 9 top 10s and 17 starts in majors. And I think that's why the sports book actually put him ahead of Patrick Cantlay as it relates to odds moving forward. So you could make the argument that he's a major player for major championships. Less PGA Tour wins, only 4 wins to his credit. Arguably, there could have been more if he was a little bit better closing on Sunday for a couple of those events. But certainly a name to look at for this year as it relates to a player that really has shown that they can contend in major championships.
Yeah, Xander likes the Country Club a lot when you dive into what he's done at that golf course. Reached the round of 16 at the 2013 U.S. Amateur, and his game has obviously complete enough to contend and play well in U.S. Opens. Well, Steve Burkowski's been itching to jump in as well. Burko, who is your pick as the best player currently without a major?
Well, Shane, I'm on the Paige McKenzie bandwagon with Xander Schauffele. She rattled off some of those numbers, 9 top 10s in his starts in major championships. And how about 6 of those being top 5s, 2 seconds, 2 thirds? We remember back at Erin Hills, the U.S. Open, he sort of got onto that leaderboard. Everyone's like, who is he? Where did he come from? What's he done? And seemingly at that particular major championship, a factor each and every year. It has been, though, 3 years since he's last won on the PGA Tour. A lot of missed opportunities, some opportunities taken from him as well. So I went back and forth. You sort of lean to Lee Westwood. You look at that guy that's been around for a few decades that has had opportunities. I went with this smaller sample size with Xander. When you've played in 18 majors, you've made 16 cuts, you continue to be a factor. I'm sort of looking at the bigger picture moving forward of what he is able to do, and seemingly he's got that mentality, the game, the mindset of if you got to go low at a major that particular week, he can do so. Or if you need to maybe just shoot even 1-2 under par, he has the ability. So I think Paige and I will be successful in our decision-making potentially before you guys. But it's always fun to discuss because, as you said, there's no right or wrong answer.
Yeah, Burko, I mean, Xander, Cantlay, Lee Westwood, Ricky Fowler, on down the list. All these players have the game and the potential to win a major championship. And where are those major championships this season? 84 days away from the Masters, that, of course, at Augusta National, PGA Championship at Southern Hills, the U.S. Open at the Country Club, as we mentioned. Xander played well and the U.S. Amateur there in 2013. And then the Open, circle it, put it in bold, the Old Course, St. Andrews, for the final men's major of 2022. Well, a deep dive with unprecedented access inside the ropes of the season's biggest events is coming to Netflix in the form of a documentary series. Today, the PGA Tour formally introduced the series, which is currently in process of filming a number of big-time names. You seen this list yet? The names involved in this: Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, Colin Morikawa, Max Homa, Harry Higgs. How are you not watching this, Eamon? You're watching this.
I'm going to be glued to it just like everyone else in this game, Shane.
Maybe we'll watch it together?
Yeah, we could.
We'll talk about it offline.
Netflix
offline.
And chill.
Okay, okay. We'll talk about it later. All right, one guy took himself off that list this past season of players without a major title is Hideki Matsuyama out on the driving range. Coming up, we'll just talk about Hideki's year after the win at Augusta National and what we expect from that superstar in 2022.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And by the Hawaiian Islands. Visit GoHawaii.com/golf.
One of the all-time walk-offs in PGA Tour history, the Aoki Eagle 1983. I mean, imagine today. Imagine this happening today, Eamon, on social media. How crazy the world would have gone.
And imagine being Jack Renner, sitting there watching it happen to you. You see him looking a little deflated right here? He came back a year later and won the Sony Open in a playoff.
Oh, dejected look. What a shot.
It's the first Japanese winner ever on the PGA Tour.
Take a look at the most PGA Tour wins by players from Japan. And, of course, Hideki well ahead of the rest with seven. You mentioned it, Aoki winning in 83, first ever by a player from Japan. Hideki has now proven he is the best men's player from Japan that we have seen. And obviously, he put an exclamation mark on that with the win at Augusta National in 2021, becoming the first men's major champion from Japan. That Saturday, second nine, was special stuff. After the weather delay, Hideki came out and just threw darts. He was in the alleyway at the 11th, great shot into 12. You remember he had a great shot into 13, three putts for par, and then his shot into 15 and 16. You know, Hideki's just one of those players. We talked about heaters earlier in the show. I mean, Hideki's a player that when the iron play starts to heat up, there's not anybody in the world that can hit iron shots like Hideki can hit.
Yeah, his statistics on strokes gained approach throughout his career have really been phenomenal. He had 8 years where his worst finish was ninth. And that ninth place finish was the only year when he was outside of the top six. Until last year, he dropped all the way down to 17th
in
strokes gained approach. And that is absolutely the strength of Hideki's game. Where the weakness comes in is the putting. I mean, he currently right now on this season, and this is a season which he hasn't played that much, but he has actually won on the PGA Tour. He won the Zozo Championship. He's 205th. In strokes gained putting on tour now. There are only 15 guys worse than him with the short stick on tour, and he's not broken the top 170 in the last couple of years out there. So that's really the area of the game that poses a problem for Hideki. But do you really have a problem if you're wearing a green jacket?
When you look at his season after the win at the Masters, I mean, I'd still give his year an A grade because of the way he played. I mean, you look at what he did at the PGA Championship, the next major following the victory, got himself in the hunt after two rounds. He was just two shots off the lead, played well at the Olympics. So much pressure on Hideki there in Tokyo. And then, of course, what he did at the Zozo, you mentioned it. But just one missed cut following the win at Augusta throughout the entire season. So much pressure, so much expectation. And then after you win, there was a lot of, you know, there are people reaching for him. And he was able to kind of push hands back and still go out there and play solid golf.
And speaking to that point of people reaching for him, what you will not be able to see here, but I can assure you it's there, is there will be an absolute battery of cameras and Japanese media right behind Hideki on the range. It happens every time he's out there. And the impact of his Masters victory, we talked about it a lot back in April, this idea that he would inspire a generation of Asian stars to follow him. Well, he's already managed to inspire the current number one ranked amateur in the world, Keita Nakajima, who's also in the field here this week, who's been referring to him as Mr. Hideki in interviews. And he's only 21 years old. Hideki's only 29 years old. But there is a generation of potential superstars coming right behind him.
When we talk about superstars in golf, we need not forget Hideki Matsuyama and what he's able to do on the golf course year after year after year. So cool to see him take home the green jacket in April. Excited to see what he does in his title defense. Also excited to see what food looks like at that champions dinner. I would be very into it. I would be very, very into it.
I think it'll be an acquired taste for some of the guys with green jackets there if Hideki gets a little adventurous with his food. But you also have to remember one of the highlights of his year was the Tokyo Olympics, and he came oh so close to the medal podium. He finished tied fourth in Tokyo.
Yeah, in that playoff, tied for 13th last week as he got his 2022 started. And the Masters announced yesterday that two-time Masters champion Tom Watson will join Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player as an honorary starter at the 86th Masters Tournament. Watson won the 1977 and the 1981 Masters Tournament, finished runner-up three separate times. And our friend and colleague Tim Rosefort passed away Tuesday in Palm Beach Gardens. Tom Watson jumped on social media and thanked Chairman Ridley for the great honor there about Augusta National. Tom Watson also talked about Rosa Fort and the passing.
He was a gentleman. He did his trade. He did his work with honesty. He did his work with a very good, solid knowledge of the game that we played, that we play. I'm going to miss him. He was always a delight to be around with his angles, but also with his comments about the game. He loved the game of golf.
Some more from social media about the great Tim Rosa Fort, Rory McIlroy. Always enjoyed my conversations with Tim, a great journalist, but more importantly, a kind-hearted person who will be missed by many. My thoughts are with his family. Bryson DeChambeau on social as well. Terrible news to hear today. Tim was an amazing reporter and a respected journalist. Had a lot of great conversations throughout the few years I was on tour, sending my thoughts and prayers to his family today. Chris Paul on social as well. Since 2009, second to only basketball, I've watched more golf than anything. Prayers to Tim's family. Although I'd never met him, I listened to and watched him all the time, was always full of energy, and kept me engaged as a fan of golf. Mike Tirico, so sad to hear the news of Tim's passing, so honored to know him the last two decades and to work next to him over the last few years. Prayers to his family and friends. And Rosie had so many of those. Quite a man. David Duvall on social media. Tremendously sad to hear of Tim's passing. Abundantly kind and fair to all he came across. Blessed to have known him my entire career. More blessed to call him my friend. We all just lost a beautiful person. And Damon Hack on social as well. Tim was the ultimate reporter and teammate. A friend who never blinked when he needed help. He was tough and vulnerable, serious and witty. He was real. Thank you, Rosie. Blessed to have known you and to have followed in your large footsteps. Rest in peace. Golf Today continues after this. Get another check on this date in history. 2007, Tad Fujikawa making the cut at the Sony Open in Hawaii. Eamon, this is one of those stories you had to follow.
Yeah, and he became much more impactful later in his life as well when he became the first professional golfer ever to come out. But this was his coming out week originally back in 2007.
So it's 2022, full field event at the Sony. Talking about some of the rookies, and here's some notable rookie seasons since 1990. John Daly in 91, well, he won the PGA Championship as the ninth alternate. Ernie Els in 94 won the U.S. Open in a playoff. Woody Austin in 95, a win in seven top tens. Tiger makes every list all the time, no matter what. Two victories in his rookie season. Qualified for the Tour Championship in just seven starts. Todd Hamilton in 04, two wins, including the Open. Keegan Bradley, if you remember, in 2011, won twice, including that PGA Championship. And then Jordan Spieth in 2013, a win and a runner-up three separate times. So how about those rookies, Eamon? How about the rookies this season? Who do you have your eye on?
Well, I think the term rookie is a bit of a misnomer these days, Shane, because so many of these guys come out seasoned and ready to win, and particularly the guys coming out now, because we just finished a super season on the Korn Ferry Tour, which went over 30 events. And one of the guys who actually won twice on that I have my eye on is Cameron Young. He almost won the Sanderson's Farms in his second start in his rookie year on the PGA Tour. And to me, there's value in that because nerves, it tends to be what hobbles rookies when they finally unexpectedly get themselves in the unfamiliar territory at the glamorous end of the leaderboard on a Sunday afternoon. And he's already gotten that experience out of the way and taken some lessons from that as well. And to me, the stat that you really got to look at with this guy, he leads the tour right now in driving distance at 323 yards a pop. That's going to play
listening?
Everywhere.
Is Bryson listening to the show? I mean, this is a guy that has had the confidence. He's played major championships. He's qualified into multiple U.S. Opens. But just looking at some of the list, and to your point, these quote-unquote rookie names are some of the names that we've followed. I look at Alex Smalley there. You know, he's a guy that's ranked 319th in the world, but he's already got two top 15 finishes in the fall. He finished in a tie for 12th in Bermuda, tie for 15th in Houston. I mean, these are players that are so hungry. Professional golf has changed, Eamon, so much, where these players used to kind of slowly get into the process of being a pro golfer and to be a PGA Tour player. Now all these players expect to contend and win quickly. They don't need that buffer season anymore.
And they don't have the luxury of it either. There are 27 rookies on the tour this year. And when you look back through the list of FedEx Cup finishes over the last 10, 15 years, it's very, very rare that you actually see more than one rookie make it to Eastlake at the end of the year. It's just not common. It's very uncommon for them to actually even really get into the playoffs, period. But there's some guys this year making a little move early. Right now, there are four rookies in the top 50 on the FedEx Cup. There are 11 in the top 100. These guys have got to start making hay now because the Wolves are about to start knocking at the door when the big names show up again soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very interesting to kind of follow some of these names as they get their 2022 going. Paige McKenzie joins us now. Paige, who do you have your eye on in 2022 as a rookie that could shake some stuff up?
Yeah, the name I'm keeping an eye on is Chad Ramey. And when we talk about a skill set that can be transferable, he's one of the best ball strikers coming off the Corn Ferry Tour. He was third in greens and regulation last season. So far in the six starts, he's 11th in strokes gained approach on the PGA Tour. So a solid ball striker. But the reason why his name caught my eye is because he's from a very small town, Fulton, Mississippi. And, of course, I primarily follow the LPGA Tour, and Allie Ewing is also from Fulton, Mississippi. This pair grew up together, played high school golf together on the men's team, and only a 9-hole golf course in Fulton, Mississippi. So very small town, pretty incredible that two professional golfers have come out of there. This, of course, being Chad's first full year, but Allie, two LPGA wins under her belt. And they seem to be kind of following in each other's footsteps throughout their career. So maybe we'll see the same from Chad.
Paige, why do you feel like players are more prepared these days to kind of go out there and win and contend as rookies? Because we were talking a bit about that buffer year, trying to get your feet wet as a pro golfer. But it sure seems like that has gone out the window.
Yeah, I think the depth of talent has created this. Iron sharpens iron, and the way that we've seen junior golf continue to develop, amateur golf continue to develop, and the Korn Ferry Tour is absolutely the hardest tour to play on around the world. It's so fluid that it's easy to lose your card. So these players are learning how to compete under the hardest microscope and thinnest of margins. So if they are graduating from the Korn Ferry Tour, they're better prepared than ever to be able to hit the ground running, knowing how uncomfortable it can be to fight for your job week in and week out. They've already been through that before, so they're just that much more prepared.
To Paige's point, they're getting prepared faster and younger than ever. Just yesterday, Tom McKibben, who's another guy who's been under a lot of spotlight since his early teenage years, he comes from the same golf club in Northern Ireland as Rory McIlroy. He's had this mantle of the next Rory McIlroy hung around his shoulders since he could barely walk. And this guy shot a 62 yesterday and won on the minor league tour in Florida. $10,000, the first win of his professional career. He doesn't show any signs that he needs to kind of a learning curve at all.
Are you surprised that the name Phil Mickelson is still the last amateur to win on the PGA Tour, considering what we talk about? These young players are hungry. They understand the golf swing. They're confident. And they're not scared of the PGA Tour big boys when they go out there and have an opportunity to play against the pros?
That might be the next great record in this game that falls, because it's not just that these guys come off the Korn Ferry Tour season and ready to win, because you kind of expect that. It's the amateurs that we see pop up, and we don't get to see them that often outside of the major championships. But these guys are consistently showing up prepared to win, and Kita Nakajima, the number one ranked amateur in the world, may be that guy this week in Japan. That's the Sony.
Yeah,
in Hawaii.
In Hawaii. I mean, if Monday we're talking about him and seeing what he's able to do and just getting in contention. But I'm very interested to kind of watch not just the college players, but these young players that have been given this opportunity, have played their way onto the PGA Tour, and they understand what they have to go out there and do. Hungry is the term I always use, because when you're a guy that's played on PGA Tour for 5 or 10 years, hunger goes away at times. Now, you might change a little bit, and you might go out there and try to go after a tournament or a major championship you haven't yet. But home's good. You know, the couch is good. The house is paid for. The cars are there. Maybe the boat is in the water. These guys are hungry to get to that point, and they want to go out there and knock off Bryson and Jordan and Justin and Rory.
Yeah, but there's a lot of guys out there, too, Shane, who are on the second or third marriage, and they're pretty starving as well.
They're also hungry as well. They understand they got bills to pay. Well, we're excited to kind of pay attention to the rookies as the Sony gets going. And you know I love a good psycho scorecard. On Golf Today, we got a story you can't miss. A 20 handicapper that did something we're not sure has ever happened in the history of the sport. That's next.